from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Ferguson, militarized police and deadly force, U.S. action in Iraq, a Russian convoy to Ukraine, and Robin Williams. In Ferguson, Missouri, uproar at the death of Michael Brown and tear gas in the air. A new mission accomplished moment for the U.S. in Iraq, but it's not over. Here's the president.
We broke the ISIL siege of Mount Sinjar. We helped vulnerable people reach safety, and we helped save many innocent lives.
And a huge outpouring for Robin Williams, dead from apparent suicide at 63. Here he was in 2006 on Fresh Air.
Do I perform sometimes in a manic style? Yes. Am I manic all the time? No. Do I get sad? Oh, yeah. Does it hit me hard? Oh, yeah.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Laura Jakes of the AP, Marcus Mabry of the New York Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What are you thinking on Ferguson, Iraq, Robin Williams? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington today is Laura Jakes, national security correspondent for the Associated Press, former Baghdad bureau chief for the AP. Laura Jakes, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
From New York, Marcus Mabry joins us, editor-at-large for the New York Times, author of Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice and Her Path to Power, and White Bucks and Black Eyed Peas, Coming of Age Black in White America. Marcus Mabry, welcome to you.
Thanks, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Laura, and Marcus.
The whole country looking at Ferguson, Missouri this week. It started on Saturday with the shooting death of Michael Brown. Here was an interview with Reuters. This is a witness, Tiffany Brown, describes what she saw happen when Michael Brown was shot and killed. She said she didn't see the beginning of the encounter, but arrived and saw that the police officer and Michael Brown were tussling through the window, her words. She said it looked like the kid was pulling away. The officer was pulling him in. It's only one account. And then she said she saw a shot fired through the window.
After the shot, the kid breaks away, and he starts running away from the cop. The cop follows him and kept shooting, and the kid body jerked as if he was hit. And after his body jerked, he turned around, he puts his hands up, and the cop just continues to walk up on him and shoot him until he goes all the way down.
In the days that followed, peaceful protests during the day, big trouble at night, and heavily armed police, militarized police in the streets. By yesterday, the governor of Missouri was on it, Jay Nixon, a Democrat, saying a full investigation will be carried out. Called for people of Ferguson to use their energy towards something positive, he said.
We just can't have lawlessness in this. We've got to stick with it. We've got to use this energy and not use it as an excuse to spin off, but use it as an excuse to push forward.
But here's one of those protesters, Megan Flannery, arrested earlier this week, telling the Washington Post in a phone interview that she and many other peaceful protesters had done nothing wrong. The atmosphere created by the police was all wrong.
The police officers have become over-militarized and for no reason at all. I understand that crowd control is a difficult thing, but when the crowd control is not needed, the military gear and apparel is also not needed. And so it's been creating an atmosphere in the city that is not conducive to human life.
A saga already, and it's not even a week since the incident that kicked all this off. Marcus Mabry, what's the arc of this story at this point? What have we learned, and where is this turning? It was fairly peaceful last night after the governor turned policing over to the State Highway Patrol and a more local guy took charge, marched with the marchers. What's the arc of this story, Marcus?
Well, I think we're seeing a calming, and I say that understanding the risk of making that prediction.
Sure.
But the fact that we've now have Captain Ronald Johnson of the State Highway Patrol, who's now in charge, who is an African American who has local roots, in charge of the police presence, I think that's going to make a huge difference. The real kind of wild card in this, unfortunately, is the fact that now that Ferguson's police captain has come out and actually given the name of the police officer who was involved in the shooting, that being Darren Wilson, mm-hmm. who he said is a 6-year veteran of the force, that may stoke angers and passions again. We don't know what the community's viewpoint will be toward that officer or toward those around him. So that is a risk in this. I think there are two overwhelming overarching points that are important to make about the story and what's going to happen to it going forward. Number one, as the subject, as the source just said, one of the reasons we're seeing this is because of the militarization of American local police forces. After 9/11, we gave out billions of dollars to local police forces to basically have military weaponry, which they didn't need, which we thought in the fear and hysteria after 9/11, and when we thought we were on a war on terror that would be fought potentially on every inch of American soil domestically, we geared up our police forces to be military. So that's why in these unfortunately, African-American men being killed unarmed by American police is not a new story. Unfortunately, it happens far too often. But it is this militarization of the police that has allowed this to go in the direction it's gone in. Then the second thing I think is interesting is politically in America, we would have had most politicians coming out at one point not very long ago talking about this lawlessness and how it must stop and the war on crime. But in fact, you have both Republicans and Democrats coming out and saying that the police response here has been literally embarrassing. And the whole world is looking at this and saying this is the United States. So that's a real difference in our politics. That has really, frankly, surprised me.
Laura Jakes, social media just exploded over this week. Beyond the explosion in the streets, it was here, it was around the world, and people saying, maybe this looks like something out of 1960s USA, but it looks more recently like something out of Tahrir Square. People abroad dismayed at lots of things here, but not least the amount of armament and body armor and weaponry in the streets of a small American town over, you know, this wasn't a revolution, this was a killing and a response to it. Really striking how the world was talking about this, Laura.
I agree. I also have been watching this and on social media and have seen some comments from people abroad who would, I think, like to remind Americans that what's happening in Ferguson, although very shocking and striking, is not a war zone. People in Baghdad and in Erbil in Syria are used to going out of their homes and being bombed. Certainly that's not happening here in Ferguson. But going back to sort of the militarization of police, I would like to note that even military officials and military soldiers who have deployed to these war zones overseas from the United States say that they don't even use this level of what they call battle rattle or gear to go in on many of their missions. So I think it was very shocking to people back here in the United States who are in the armed forces, certainly shocking to many other police departments. I think the city of St. Louis police chief came out and said that this was surprising to him, the level of militarization that we're seeing in the streets of Ferguson.
And there was something in the attitude of those police as well. Again, we don't know exactly what happened yet in the initial incident. The chyrons running now on television news are saying, you know, that Michael Brown stole cigars before shooting. We don't know exactly what happened, but the response, absolutely remarkable. The attitude, sort of guns, assault rifles pointed out at people, American citizens in the street, and then reporters shut down as well. This was Wednesday night in Ferguson. Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowry was charging his phone in a Ferguson McDonald's a few blocks from the scene of Michael Brown's shooting when, as Lowry said, he said police arrested him. Huffington Post reporter Ryan Riley as well, saying they were trespassing. Lowry caught the beginning of that encounter on tape.
Grab your stuff. Let's go.
I'm working on it.
Stop videotaping. Let's grab our stuff and go.
Right to videotape you, sir.
Hurry up. Let's go.
Please don't make a gun at me.
Let's go.
You see me working. Please do not tell me not to use my personal.
It's time to go. Let's go.
Please not wave a gun.
We're down about 45 seconds. Let's go.
Please don't wave the gun. Jack Beatty, what's up with the attitude we're seeing here in the streets?
Well, you know, that vignette encapsulates some of it. You know, it's almost as if some of these policemen dressed up in this military garb are sort of getting off on the regalia, the swagger, the swatness of it all. It is it's a disturbing thing to see. It's also disturbing to me at least, that action, the governor took action to lift this siege of Ferguson by the SWAT teams, only after the arrest of two white reporters. I mean, if they hadn't been arrested, would this just simply have been allowed to go on? I don't want to think so, but it's there. You know, it's hard. Who can not sympathize with police? My gosh, they're the catchers in the rye of social dysfunction. It all falls on them. Poverty, racism, unemployment. It all comes down to them. And yet, we expect more from them, and we have to expect more. And, you know, it's disturbing. I check with Human Rights Watch. It's disturbing that although there's a 1994 law requiring the Justice Department to collect information and publish information about the abuse of force by police forces, it has never been done. There is no official list of this. There's no official accounting. We have to start there, and we have to work down until we demilitarize police forces and make them accountable to the public they serve.
People across all kinds of lines, deeply uneasy, and much more this week over what we have seen right there in Ferguson, Missouri. This is a big story, and it is by no means over. Here's the president. This was in on Martha's Vineyard, saying, "Well, let's chill out.
Now's the time for healing. Now's the time for peace and calm on the streets of Ferguson. Now is the time for an open and transparent process to see that justice is done."
We don't know where this is going yet. The name of the police officer involved in the shooting, Darren William Wilson, now public record, released by Ferguson Police today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news. Ferguson, militarized police, the U.S. back in Iraq, Russia's convoy to Ukraine, Robin Williams, and more. Lara Jakes is with us, a national security correspondent for the Associated Press. Marcus Mabry is with us from New York, editor-at-large at the New York Times. Jack Beatty's here. The pain expressed on the streets in Ferguson, really moving. Here was Monica Timmons talking with NPR on Monday.
I don't have kids, and this is why. I do not want to be scared to have a son in America. Like, ain't you scared to have one? You know, like, let's be real. You know, what do our sons got to look forward to? You want to bring a son to this so he can get killed? No.
Marcus Mabry, Charles Blow, columnist writing in the columns of your newspaper, about a sense of tragedy too often repeated in this killing of Michael Brown and its aftermath. The sense that we should be beyond this by now, but we're clearly not.
Well, you know, it's hard to talk about this, and obviously as journalists we get to exercise a certain distance from these stories. But even so, that professional distance is kind of an inoculation for many of us. I'm an African-American male, and I grew up in America, and I am very cognizant of what the woman just said about why she doesn't have kids. And while that may sound hyperbolic to people, I have to say, as an African-American male myself and as an African-American dad, my partner and I have two boys who are only 4 years old, but they're biracial, our children. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, it is a source of comfort for me because it does scare me very much what I'd have to tell my kids. I will have to tell them anyway as African-American men, but the fact that they are biracial and are lighter skinned may save their lives at some point. And that is a chilling reality. And, you cannot help but be personally affected by that reality as a black man in America.
Let's go to our listeners. People are really thinking about this one. Philip in Henniker, New Hampshire. Philip, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I wanted to point out to you and to your panelists, this is no surprise. This phenomenon has been studied for years, most notably Zimbardo's prison study, where he took volunteers, put some in prison guard uniforms and others in the uniforms of prisoners, and had to actually stop his experiment because of the violence that was wrought on the prisoners by the pretend guards. Uniforms falsely inflate people's attitudes and people's power.
Uniforms, and maybe the more combat style the uniform, the more inflated. I don't know, Laura Jakes, things were looking very combat-y on the streets of Ferguson this week. Big equipment, big rifles, all that body armor, and the photos and video that ensued.
Yes. As Mark has said, billions of dollars worth of military equipment since 2001. But, you know, I'd like to add that going back on something you said, Tom, it's hard, I believe, for the country to put some of these tensions behind us when tactics like police dogs are still being used for crowd control. You'd think that people would have learned from 50 years ago that maybe this isn't the best kind of use of crowd control to use in some of these areas where racial tensions can be inflamed. You know, something Jack said a second ago, that you need to expect more from the United States. I mean, that's what makes the United States different from countries across the world. This is not a police state. There's no expectation that the U.S. is a police state. And so tactics like these, just that's why I believe you see the outcry against tactics like these. And, you know, going back to the arrest of, or at least the detention of the two reporters, they were only held for, I think, a few hours at most, but they were never charged. And when they were released, according to the social media reports I saw, and in the Washington Post as well, one of the reporters, of course, was with the Washington Post, he made it sound like the police chief, or at least the officers who released them, said it was, you know, a favor to them to be released. You can't hold people in the United States without being charged. It just can't be done. And there's no favor implied here when you are roughed up, trying to do your job, not inciting any violence whatsoever, and hauled away.
Jack, this isn't Cairo, Egypt. I mean, what is going on here? This idea, this attitude that you can just take people into custody, even reporters who show you clearly that they are journalists, with impunity, never mind all the mayhem going on in the street itself. Where does this come from? Are we watching too much global news and thinking, well, we'll just do that too?
I think there's something to that, and I think Philip is partly onto something, that just what happens to these people when they put on these belts and these tunics and the helmets and the whole thing, they go SWAT. I mean, it is just, but you know, when you look at this, I mean, everyone has pointed this out, but here's a town that is 29% white, 69% black. This police force, 3 of 53 officers are black. This cries out for diversity. I mean, you can't have essentially that's a kind of occupying force right there on the numbers, which isn't to say that race is some sort of, you know, absolute barrier in America, but historically it has been, and we can't get away from that. And when you have police departments with those statistics, this kind of behavior seems to flow from that. You just can't imagine if it were half and half that those officers would say, yes, we have to stand out there and point machine guns at people. It just seems inconceivable.
Jay in Buffalo, New York. Jay, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I wanted to clear up a few different points about the police as a police officer and a SWAT team member that you guys have misconceptions about.
Okay.
As a general rule, yeah, we did receive a lot of new equipment since 9/11, a lot of military-styled equipment. But you guys have to realize that we have been facing a lot more threats. There's high-powered rifles. We have kids going into schools with high-powered rifles. We have people shooting up malls. We have a lot more violence and a lot more stuff to go up against. And we need armored vehicles. Our cars, our regular cars, are not equipped to take rounds from a rifle.
But look what happened last night, Jay. Look, if you'd stick with us here, I mean, you've got experience of this, but when we got a different force in there, and they weren't so armed up, and they didn't have body armor all over, and they walked in the street with the protesters, and we had a calm night last night.
Okay, and the night that the riot happened, and which could have turned even worse, if somebody had, you know, what I'm saying is we have to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. You can't go in there, you know, with you know, maybe normal police gear, and if somebody starts to riot and you're unprepared and police get hurt because of that, then they say, why weren't the police prepared for this? You know, they knew this could be in a volatile situation, and then everybody can Monday morning quarterback this and say, oh, they were too armed, too prepared, too, you know, covered in body armor. But then if something happens to one of those police officers, their family's suing. Other police are in an uproar.
Yeah, no, Jay, I take the point. I know there's real danger there, and police put themselves at risk. But as an American citizen, I don't want police that look like an occupying army in my community. And I'm sure the people in Ferguson don't either. Still, there's that danger. We're a heavily armed country. That's true. DJ in Lexington, Kentucky. DJ, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you think?
just a quick comment. I've got former police experience, about 6 years in North Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been my experience that the majority of the officers that we had, and I have seen come through the ranks, have been ex-military. So they bring that philosophy with them from the military, from their training. They're bringing in this heavy gun mentality that says that the only way to stop what's going on out in the community is to bring out the heavy weaponry, let people see it, then they know that we're in charge. And I have no military myself. I did not agree with that philosophy. It didn't work. It didn't fit well with the department that I didn't agree with that philosophy, and naturally I relinquished my position. But I would go into a situation and I would survey for what it was. If it required that kind of response, then I would generally go through the chain of command and set it up that way. I wouldn't actually go in all guns blazing and just show the big guns and expect the people to understand that we are in charge. That's not how it works. And as a comprehensive, competent police officer, one that who does not have military experience, I think is more suited to go into a situation like that where there's hostile folks, there's people out there angry, and a police officer that's not military trained, that's been trained through a proper academy course curriculum, will understand how to handle that situation. Generally, military folks, they make great police officers, but I think they're a little bit too
ready to come in heavy. Maybe DJ, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Marcus Mabry, what about it? After so many years at war, maybe we've got some of that mentality flowing into our domestic security setup.
These are incredibly hard questions that we're talking about here, and I think both, and you know, Laura was right when she talked about some. There are many veterans actually who've come home and they've said we actually would not have done it this way in the military situation. In fact,
yes.
And so some of those soldiers actually have actually more or better equipped to actually be on our streets because they've actually have gotten kind of how to deal with crowd controls, how to deal with potential adversaries, how to deal with potential adversaries.
We've seen this week. Andrew Exum, big military thinker, repeatedly tweeting, you know, if you want to dress like a Marine, join the Marines. You want to be in an occupying force, go abroad. Don't bring this home to the country we're defending. This is a military man saying this.
Right. And I have to also point out, it goes the other way, too. Unfortunately, some of our soldiers actually were working in these nations where people are darker than them. Some of those soldiers actually have kind of brought American racist attitudes with them to the forces over there. Our military has had to kind of counter and educate that. So it goes both ways. But I think some of our vets are actually better equipped because of their experience, but some are not. And the Washington Post had a great piece where veterans talked about, you know, this is not what we were taught to do with crowd control over there. So we certainly shouldn't do it at home. So it cuts both ways, but they are hard questions. And police are out there. They are the front lines, right? And it's true that they are dealing with some lethal stuff in America, more lethal than any other Western country. So, yes, there is some need for the body armor stuff. However, it's a question of having leadership at the top of your force that understands what should be the rapport of forces, what should you go in with, both as far as physical equipment and mental preparation when you have, say, a riot situation. And I think it's pretty clear that St. Louis County didn't have that kind of leadership.
May I jump in very quickly?
Yes, please, Lara. Yes, please.
I would just like to say that I think a lot of it also comes down to training. You know, you have to wonder if police forces or SWAT teams even, and I would have liked to have heard Jay and Buffalo's perspective on this, whether they were adequately trained to drive a Humvee or to use an MRAP or some of these military pieces of equipment that are being now given to police forces. I know the military in the United States has to go under, you know, hours and hours of driving these vehicles, of using these types of guns. They have to go on firing ranges. They have to requalify. So I think that one perhaps difference between the military use of this equipment and civilian police forces is just the training that goes in. And that goes into, you know, what Marcus said about leadership. Leaders have to be able, if you're going to have the toys, you need to know how to use them adequately and you need to know how to use them appropriately. And I would like to have heard from Jay whether or not he feels like he has that training, or the police officer down in northern Georgia.
I mean, we did hear this week in the military, you don't aim your gun without reason. Here we saw police in Missouri pointing those high-powered weapons all over the place at American citizens. much more on this front, a kind of real-time education going on as to what's going on in our streets this week and all kinds of learning being taken from it. We're not finished with it, and we won't be, I don't imagine, for some time here. The name of the officer now released, Darren Wilson. Of course, there's a dead young man, and nobody knows exactly what happened yet. FBI investigation ongoing. Local police taken out of policing those protests now, and we'll see where that goes. Big action as well in Iraq this week. Not least, just last night, controversial Iraqi Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki, after lots of urging from the United States and more, Iran importantly, agreed to step aside and his legal challenge to his nominated replacement, Haider al-Abadi. Here's Maliki speaking last night.
He's
saying there, I'm withdrawing my candidacy in the interest of my fellow Haider al-Abadi, doing all that is needed to protect the higher interest of the country. Lara Jakes, what got Maliki to finally step aside?
Well, I think that there are two major forces of influence here, and then one to a lesser extent. You might be surprised to hear that I believe that the United States is probably the force of lesser extent here. Okay. Maliki is more concerned about Iran and the leadership there, urging the country to have new leadership, as did the country's main Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani. Has huge influence over the Shia population in Iraq. Shias are 60% of the population in Iraq. Maliki himself is a Shia. Mm-hmm. This is a big, big deal, the fact that Maliki is finally stepping down. I was more pessimistic about this happening than I think many in Washington, just because I have seen Maliki for years hold on to power. He has fiercely protected his power over the years against criticism that he has prevented Iraq's Sunni population, about 20% of the country's population, from participating in government, from getting mm-hmm. jobs. In 2010, for example, Prime Minister al-Maliki was able to keep power in Iraq, even though his party didn't win the most votes in the national election. And so this time it's kind of a bit of a reversal. His party did win the most votes in the national election in April. He's the Dahua party leader, so you would think that he would keep control of the premiership. But because of all of this influence, he finally decided yesterday to drop his legal challenges and to step aside and to let Haider al-Abadi become the next prime minister.
Also a member of his, the Dawa party there. Jack Beattie, what do you see happening this week? We had President Obama kind of declare victory on this Sinjar Mountain standoff over the Yazidi and Chuck Hagel as well, saying we did our job. They can flow back out of there now. Yeah. But you still got dire reports out of the Yazidi. It's not clear to me at this mission accomplished moment what it meant or what just happened.
It's not clear at all. Yesterday was the 60th day since the president committed the first tranche of military advisors to Iraq. The War Powers Resolution of 1973 requires the president, after 60 days, to go to Congress for approval of committing forces like this. The idea was to prevent a president from slipping down the slope to war on his own authority. And with Syria, the president, I think, wisely bowed to congressional and public sentiment and backed off his threat to strike Syria after the use of chemical weapons. There was no support for it. He wasn't going to sort of buck his constitutional authority there. And you wonder, I mean, suppose he summoned Congress back and said, I want you to vote on this. That would be a bold move, but it would, of course, probably hurt his party and he wouldn't do it. But it is, we have that law, the clock is ticking, and the point of that law was to prevent slipping into war.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a sad funeral yesterday for Kevin Ward, Jr., who was killed this week during a sprint car race in Canandaigua, New York. Ward got out of his car to confront NASCAR star Tony Stewart on the track, was struck by Stewart's car, and died. Respect at the funeral, but dismay from this fan.
I thought the guy that got out of his car was a complete idiot. Because it's a live racetrack. You don't do that. I don't care. Unless you're on fire, there's no reason to get out of your car.
Iranian mathematician Maryam Mirzakhani became the first woman to win the prestigious Fields Medal, considered math's Nobel Prize. She described how she fell in love with math.
I got excited about it, maybe just as a challenge. But then I realized that it's really nice and that I enjoy it.
And iconic Hollywood star Lauren Bacall, dead at 89. Here she was with husband Humphrey Bogart in 1946's The Big Sleep.
Yes. The only trouble is we could have had a lot of fun if you weren't a detective.
We still can.
So long.
So long, Lauren Bacall. What a voice, what a persona. We're looking at a week in the news. Ferguson, militarized police, the U.S. in Iraq, Russia's convoy to Ukraine, Robin Williams, and that apparent suicide this week. Marcus Mabry is with us from the New York Times. Lara Jake is from the Associated Press, national security correspondent there. Jack Beatty's here. A little more on Iraq, plenty of emotion there. ISIS, the Islamic State, Yazidis saying that they've just been slaughtering people. Here was a refugee woman in one of the camps talking with CNN about her family's encounter with ISIS.
ISIS came to our village. I pleaded them not to kill us. I gave them money, everything I had. As we left, they started firing from behind and shot my 8-year-old daughter in the head. We buried her on the mountain.
Tales of beheading and forced conversion or the threat of death. Big problems here. All the way back in June, NPR's Alice Fordham talked with the man who is now Iraq's prime minister, headed into that seat, Haider al-Abadi, about the need. He spoke about the need for unity in the midst of this, what he called, terrorist threat.
Our country is under threat. And regardless of whose fault it is, we are now all under threat. This is not internal politics. This is terrorism against the state, against normal people. So we have to face up to it.
Marcus Mabry, you've run correspondents all over the world in your career. What do you see unfolding in Iraq and the American involvement here? A humanitarian job done and we're out, or are we on some kind of escalator?
Well, the Yazidis came out pretty forcefully and said very quickly that the American assessment that, in fact, we would not need to send a significant number of ground troops to rescue them from the mountain was overblown. They said actually that the crisis was still going on. There were still hundreds, perhaps thousands, we don't know, of Yazidis still stuck up there on Mount Signor. So they say that we already have overestimated how good things are, as it were. The real question for me, and of course Laura is an expert here and knows much better than I do, but I don't see how, even if this particular humanitarian crisis does subside very quickly, I don't see how Iraq makes it forward from here. I don't see how you might hope, for instance, as the prime minister designate was saying, you might hope that now that Iraqis have a common enemy, they would unite together as a people and as a nation. But I don't even see that happening. I see the Kurds actually going further in their direction of autonomy and separation from the rest of Iraq. And I don't see how nationhood grows out of this crisis. And that's the hardest thing for me is I don't see the way forward for a united Iraq here that's at peace.
Lara Jakes, in his first big comments on this new crisis in Iraq, the president suggested that if there was a change of government in Baghdad, the United States might help not just the Kurds, but the Baghdad government itself militarily. What do you see on the horizon here, Lara?
Well, the State Department has said repeatedly that if there are threats to U.S. Personnel and facilities in Iraq, i.e. in Baghdad, where the embassy is located in the Green Zone, that there would be some more overt military assistance on the level of airstrikes, like what we're seeing up in Erbil as a result of ISIS, the Islamic State, making advances onto that city where the U.S. consulate is. I think the important thing to remember here is that regardless of a new change in government, which I think everyone welcomes, this is not going to immediately change the ground situation in Iraq. There is so much unrest here. There's a huge threat that's posed by the Islamic State, or Daesh as it's known in Arabic. They are now spreading across Iraq, across Syria, into Lebanon that we're seeing now. I think that the Obama administration has made clear they really do not want to get drawn back into a combat situation in Iraq. They have said repeatedly that there will not be boots on the ground. And yet, as you noted, there are some boots on the ground. They're the administration is trying to make the distinction that they are not in direct combat. And the Iraqi government has begged, pleaded for more military assistance. I don't have any indication that major bolstered military assistance is on the way or will ever be on the way. But at the same time, the administration cannot ignore this regional threat that's being posed by a growing, ever-strengthening Islamic State.
Jack, we know President Obama has fairly well proven he doesn't want to be involved in Iraq, but here we are, and I feel abused by euphemism somehow here this week. You know, it's just to protect U.S. personnel or facilities. I mean, you could put one American down in the middle of Iraq and then send in the U.S. Army. I'm thinking, you know, I placed a jar in Tennessee, kind of Wallace Stevens poetry comes to mind. It seems to me that we are setting up to defend potentially a lot here that we've already spent 11 years working on.
Yes, and you know, if you look at history, the record of these quasi-humanitarian missions stretching into prolonged belligerencies, it's not encouraging. To give a relevant Kurdistan-related example, in April 1991, you remember Saddam Hussein was attacking the Kurds, and President George H.W. Bush ordered humanitarian assistance and airstrikes and then declared a no-fly zone in northern Iraq. And he was asked about it, how long it would go on. He said, "We're talking about days, not weeks or months." The no-fly zone went on for 10 years. That is, for 10 years, we were putting flights daily over that territory and occasionally backing, you know, not just having flights, but striking at Iraqi forces. That's a very disturbing precedent. Now, the president didn't set a time limit, but he's aware of this record. He knows how these things, especially with Kurdistan, have slipped. And we could be looking at a very long sort of quasi-war from the air in Kurdistan and Iraq.
Marcus Mabry,
but Jack, you know, those no-fly zones were not particularly, I'm sorry, but those no-fly zones were not particularly successful. I think most military officials in the time would say that. Tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of Kurds and Sunnis, Shia in southern Iraq were killed during that time. And I think the administration is looking at that and saying, you know, how much really can we impact here?
Time will tell. Hillary Clinton weighing in on the foreign policy front this week in comments that sounded fairly critical of Barack Obama from a tougher kind of perspective. Talking with Jeffrey Goldberg, interview in The Atlantic, she said that the failure to help build a credible fighting force of people who were originators of the protest against Assad, that is, in Syria, left a big vacuum, which the jihadists have now filled. She said, talked about great nations. She said they need organizing principles and don't do stupid stuff. President Obama's foreign policy mantra is not an organizing principle. Marcus Mabry, what's the positioning going on here by the potential presidential candidate Clinton?
Well, Tom, you'd said before the break that Hillary Clinton might have been trying to sound more macho on foreign policy than Barack Obama. In fact, Hillary Clinton is more macho than Barack Obama on foreign policy.
It's not a sound, it's a fact, all right?
Exactly. And it's been that way for her entire career and for his entire career. Her foreign policy is a lot more interventionist, a lot more muscular, a lot more like, you know, she'd hate to hear it, George W. Bush's. A lot less, you know, Obama's, you know, don't do anything stupid is fundamentally, I'm not going to call it retracting from the world. It's certainly not isolationism, but it is certainly not a muscular, aggressive, forward-looking, forward-leaning foreign policy. And we have seen it. I mean, on the positive side, the U.S. Has extracted ourselves to some extent as much as possible, but, you know, not to maximum effect from a lot of our wars, but at the same time, they keep dragging us back in, kind of like the mafia, right? You know, try to get out, and they keep dragging me back in.
Back
that's
we go.
Happened in Iraq, and so I think Obama has not gotten us in any other military adventures, and you know, and the Bushies, the neoconservatives might say that it's because the America's lack of commitment, ironically, to Iraq that we find ourselves where we are today. Most serious thinking foreign policy analysis would not concur in that regard, but that's what they would say. Hillary Clinton wouldn't say that, but she would say, as she did, that a lack of vigilance and a lack of forward thinking and a lack of, one might say, a lack of chutzpah, for instance, in arming the Syrian rebels early on, has in fact lessened America's ability to influence events on the ground. Again, this is a long time foreign policy debate that both on the left and on the right there are people who believe you should be more adventurous and those who believe you should be left. So it's not even a political divide. And interestingly, it would be very interesting if Hillary Clinton were to get the Democratic nomination and if Rand Paul, who is such a dark horse, I couldn't imagine it, if Rand Paul were to get the Republican nomination and you have a fight where basically you'd have the Democrats fighting for a more muscular foreign policy and the Republicans fighting for a less interventionist foreign policy.
Get tough historically, at least recently, been the presidential winning posture. We'll see this time. Here was Hillary Clinton on Martha's Vineyard, where she had dinner with the president this week, trying to kind of smooth things over.
We agree. We are committed to the values and the interests and the security of our country together. We have disagreements, as any partners and friends, as we are, might very well have. But I'm proud that I served with him and for him, and I'm looking forward to seeing him tonight.
Laura Jakes, look with us for just a minute at this Russian convoy that's been headed for Ukraine. Depending on when our listeners hear this broadcast, that may be there. Here's a little bit from an NPR interview this morning with Financial Times reporter Courtney Weaver, who's been riding along with that convoy, about what those trucks are.
In reality, they've been tarped over with white tarp or painted white. And then when they started to open up the vehicles, you can see the green on the inside. So these are standard Russian military trucks.
Of course, it could still be humanitarian relief. What do you see in this Russian convoy, Laura?
Well, the last reports I saw is that the Russian troops or the people who were driving those military trucks did let the Red Cross stop, inspect, and distribute the aid in Luhansk in eastern Ukraine. So it looks for now that the crisis has been averted. But make no mistake, the administration and I think many in the West have been very looking at this eagle-eyed to make sure that the Moscow is not using this aid convoy, I think 200-some trucks, as a pretense to get into Ukraine and to help the separatists. Earlier this week, it looked like the convoy was headed towards checkpoints that were controlled by the separatists. Again, these separatists are Ukraine citizens, but they want to be more aligned with Moscow and break off from Kiev. And that was seen as a way to get around the authorities in Kiev and the Ukrainian inspectors. But for now, again, it looks like the Red Cross is managing the situation, and there may, in fact, be some aid that are going to the people who are under siege in Luhansk.
And at home, Robin Williams, death by apparent suicide, and so much response to that. We've got callers lined up to talk about Robin Williams, and I want to get some of them. Ben in Akron, Ohio. Ben, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to talk about the death of Robin this week and how much his films really moved me throughout the entirety of my life. And how closely the themes really are related in his films to his death, and how you can only watch a man die so many times and be so emotionally there. Can only bring you to tears so many times, but when the inevitable end hits, it cuts deeply.
We don't like to think that this death was inevitable. I think that's part of the sorrow to see it go with suicide at the end. But clearly, this was a comedian and actor who had touched a lot of people deeply. Really had people thinking this week. Ben, thanks for that. Ramona in New Orleans, Louisiana. Ramona, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I suffered with depression and more recently post-traumatic stress disorder since Katrina, and it really saddened me when I heard about Robin Williams' death by suicide, because there's so many resources out there that are available to us, people like us, who are most of us who suffer with depression are smart and sensitive, and there are, especially for people who have the financial resources, there are just so many unconventional as well as conventional methods out there to heal. And I'm finally breaking through the wall and healing. And I can see a whole new future for myself. And I'm only 57 years old. And I'm really, really saddened that, you know, the hardest thing about, you know, depression is that we have to want just like an alcoholic or a drug addict, we have to want to change.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to want to reach out and research what's available and then, you know, take that risk and try it. But, you know, there's some EMDR, eye movement, desensitization, reprogramming.
Ramon, our time is short, but we're with you. Continue breaking through there. We want that to happen. But when Robin Williams couldn't quite do it, Jack, when he couldn't quite make it over, it really hits people. We got the news that he had early evidence of Parkinson's disease, perhaps, here from his wife. But here's a brilliant man who just couldn't stay the course, and it hurts, Jack.
It really does, and it's, you know, there's the larger question. I mean, a recent report for HHS finds that 60% of Americans with mental illness get no treatment over a typical year. The main reason, cost, but other reasons touch on the stigma, the continuing stigma associated with mental illness.
But Robin Williams could have had any treatment that his heart desired, and there he goes.
There he goes, yeah. Just a horrifying waste.
Sorrow.
And it hurts.
And it hurts.
As you said.
And it hurts. Marcus Mabry, editor-at-large with the New York Times. We're grateful to you for being with us today, Marcus. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Lara Jakes with the Associated Press, national security correspondent. Lara, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, and I love that you're playing the Good Will Hunting soundtrack in your background here.
You put your finger right on it. Jack Beatty, thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
And yes, we go out with the theme from 1997's Good Will Hunting, the film that won Robin Williams an Oscar for his portrayal of psychologist Sean McGuire. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.